I'll call the meeting of the Water Division to order. A quorum is present. We have first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Torkelson, have you had a chance to take a look at the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move their approval.
Okay, Representative Torkelson moves the approval of the March 4th, 2019 minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. Minutes stand approved. The first bill that we have on the agenda today, or the only bill that we have on the agenda today, is House File 1569, Representative Lippert. This bill has been referred to the Water Division by the Environmental Finance Division. I will move that House File 1569 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment Finance Committee. Representative Lippert, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Working Lands is a continuation of an investment made back in 2016 that allowed the Board of Water and Soil Resources to assess the environmental benefits and market potential of many perennial and winter annual crops. To survey farmers in six major watersheds as to their familiarity with and interest in planting these crops on their less productive lands, to model the impacts of land use changes on water quality, and assess the amount of subsidies needed to make these crops competitive with conventional row crops, which reduces risk for farmers to volunteer to change up their crop mix. Bowser's work was broadly supported within the agricultural community, including the Minnesota Farmers Union and the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. There continues to be broad support for Minnesota's continued investment in working lands, including landowners who want options for keeping ecologically sensitive lands in production, communities who are struggling to provide clean, safe drinking water for the residents, and agribusiness leaders who are looking at ways to diversify and food and bio-based products to meet changing consumer demands. We also have letters of support from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, Bang Brewing, and the Birchwood Cafe to organizations, companies that are starting to utilize Crenza in their products. House File 1569 provides $8.5 million in general fund support to establish the pilot phase of the Working Lands Wellhead Protection Program. It accelerates the development of self-sustaining markets for conservation crops that improve soil health, reduce runoff pollution, and enhance farm prosperity in community wellhead protection areas. Of the $8.5 million, at least $7 million will be available for subsidies to producers. This money will allow Bowser to establish long-term contracts for growers to de-risk participation. And based on preliminary farmer surveys, costs could range from $35 an acre to $125 an acre. The remaining $1.5 million is available for Bowser and for local partners who are helping implement the program. $400,000 will go towards a 0.8 FTE for program administration for 4 years. $500,000 to $700,000 would go for technical assistance for producers, agronomic assistance for participating growers, and $160,000 to $240,000 will go towards local program management as well. And with that, I'll pause and I'll turn it over to testifiers. First testifier being Bruce Miller.
Okay, thank you, Representative Lippert. Mr. Miller, if you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Bruce Miller with Minnesota Farmers Union. I want to thank Representative Lippert for sponsoring House File 1569. This is an integral and important part of the Forever Green program. This is provides an opportunity for an expansion of the work we've already done and continue to do in terms of developing new crops, partnering with the University of Minnesota and others, and working with farmers and industry to diversify and give new opportunities for a value-added products. Representative Lippert mentioned that two businesses in Minnesota, the Birchwood Cafe and the Bang Brewing Company. I just want to underline those. The Bang Brewing Company has been brewing Kernza beer, and it may be okay. I wouldn't want to attest to that fully on the record, but the other one is the Birchwood Cafe, who Minnesota Farmers Union partners with closely on their use of Kernza as a product. If you've been to the Minnesota State Fair and have been to the Farmers Union building there, the last year's award-winning and renowned BLT sandwich was made with Kernza bread baked by the Birchwood Cafe. That would not have been possible without the kind of research and development and experiences that we have gained working with the University of Minnesota and other partners. So I just wanted to be here briefly today to underline and say that Minnesota Farmers Union has supported this kind of program for a long time. Minnesota Farmers Union joins with other agricultural groups in continuing the support and urges your passage of this bill. It's an important part of the ongoing Forever Green program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to be here for you.
Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier seems somewhat reluctant to forcefully endorse or acknowledge the endorsement of the brewing company. You look like you're 21 years of age.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not hesitant. I might add that Bang Brewing is a member of Minnesota Farmers Union, so I will attest to that. And I will attest that not only is their Kernza beer good, all of their other varieties are good as well. And it's good to have members who use products like this in an effective and imaginative way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, are there any other questions for this testifier? Hearing none, next person I have on the list is Mr. Whitney Clark, I believe, from Friends of the Mississippi River. If you'd like to introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Whitney Clark. I'm the Executive Director of Friends of the Mississippi River. Thank you for taking the time today to hear this bill, which my organization strongly supports. I think you've heard some of the specifics from Representative Lippert today. My job, I think, in the line of testifiers is going to be to pull us back out to the sort of 60,000 foot level to think about the broader context that this new program inhabits in our portfolio of policies that we're using to address our water quality challenges in Minnesota. So, first of all, you know, I think we all agree that everyone has a right to clean water. Water is life, and the infrastructure for healthy, safe, clean, and affordable water should be available equitably and equally in all cities, towns, and rural homes. It's why our children's children are counting on us to protect it with strategies like the one we're talking about today. I don't need to tell this group that we continue to face some very stubborn, intractable challenges with respect to water quality in Minnesota. Many of the challenges that we have been resistant to the policy tools that we've been using thus far. We still have, as I'm sure you've all heard, 40% of Minnesota's surface waters are impaired. 10% of tested private wells exceed the health risk limit for nitrate. Many community wells have elevated nitrates as well, as you'll hear from some of our testifiers today. And the traditional policy approaches alone have just not been up to the task of getting us all the way to clean water. I'll just remind you, we have used incentives for farmers to deploy best management practices, and they work, of course, but not at the scale that's necessary for the change that we need to clean up our water. We've deployed very successfully conservation set-aside programs in Minnesota, and of course those are very, very effective, but they're very expensive. And we can't afford to take that much land, all the land we'd need to, out of production to actually get the landscape change we need to clean up our ground and surface waters. And of course, we've tried our hand at some regulatory mechanisms to try to address this, and nobody likes that. So this is a different approach. This is a working lands approach where we're using these new conservation crops perennial crops and winter annual crops that are grown for market, that can be deployed as part of the traditional ag systems, can be grown. It's compatible with corn and soybeans in those systems. And I'll just remind you some of the benefits of these conservation crops. They diversify crop portfolios and farm incomes. They restore and protect water quality. They attract investment in new rural agricultural industries. They reduce erosion. They enhance wildlife habitat. They provide pollinator forage. They enhance carbon sequestration. They protect drinking water. They reduce weed competition, minimizing tillage and herbicide applications. I could go on. They're very, very beneficial crops. But they're not being grown currently in Minnesota at scale because we lack the markets for farmers to grow them for. So what we lack in Minnesota is these well-defined markets, and a program like this that uses a temporary cost share to help farmers de-risk this transition to the new crops. So I want everybody to think of this program really at two scales. There's the local scale, which is deploying these conservation crops with a cost share in these drinking water supply management areas to try to improve drinking water in these public drinking water supply areas that have high nitrate. So it's a very important local demonstration of how this could work. The broader scale is we're trying to get some leverage underneath and begin this transition to these new crops that could eventually, hopefully sooner rather than later, be self-supporting. In other words, they won't require a big subsidy from the state because we'll have markets. Farmers will choose to grow these in rotation with their regular traditional commodities, because it makes sense for all the reasons that I stated before. One of the great things about this approach is the broad base of support. So you have farmers and environmental groups and our land grant research institution and rural water suppliers, agribusinesses, both large and small, as you'll hear today, all working together behind something that really has the power to transform this very, very challenging and stubborn problem we've been facing. So I'm very excited to be here today to support this bill. Thank you all for taking the time to hear it today, and I'm happy to take any questions if there are any.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Clark. Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Clark. Is this going to be targeted at a particular watershed?
I believe
Mr.
that...
Mr. Clark, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe that the approach of this program will be to, in the early phase, to evaluate a range of possible DWSMAs, drinking water supply management areas, to pilot it in, you know, two or three different target pilot areas.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are there studies that demonstrate that this has a direct impact on groundwater?
Mr. Clark.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson. I think we've got adequate scientific research proving that that these perennial crops and winter annual crops do have the ability to significantly impact nitrate pollution to groundwater within these DWSMAs. Of course, the definition of a DWSMA is a 10-year time of travel to the community well supply. So the closer you are to the well head, the quicker that you'll get the benefits of this program.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would like to see the studies that you're quoting.
Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think some of my colleagues who will be following me today will be able to provide some more information, but I'm sure that we can get that information to the committee.
I would appreciate that very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Are there any other questions for this testifier? Hearing none, I will next call down Mr. Wierens from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And forgive me if I mispronounced your last name. If you'd like to introduce yourself and start your testimony. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Wierens. I'm the Assistant Director for Programs and Policy with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm here to speak principally on the work that Representative Lippert had earlier described in terms of looking at this particular activity as well. If you want more detail, we'll be happy to come back and go through a very lengthy report. But we went through a multi-phase project back starting in 2016 to really take a look at how do we look at alternative ways to protect our stormwater resources. And I think before I even talk about that, I think it's just to state kind of what is the board's interest in this work, just for the committee's information as well. You know, our mission at Bowser is to restore, protect the state's stormwater resources in partnership with landowners and local organizations, and that's exactly the approach we took to this particular this particular report. The work we do across the state is really, there are two principal ways of getting at water and soil protection that we've been using. There's voluntary conservation, the Reinvest in Minnesota program, conservation cost share programs that we operate. There's also regulatory approaches that we deal with as well. We view this as a third way to try and make improvements to the protection of our water resources, both surface and groundwater. How do we use the power of the private market and the economic incentive of producers through making profitable crops available to them as well that have water quality benefits as a very key part of the work that they in fact do. So, you know, the work that we did and worked with a very broad range of stakeholders over a roughly two-year time period. The report was completed last February as well. Again, just in very brief, we worked with the University of Minnesota and an economics professor to take a close look at how do we try and quantify what some of the economic potential is. How do you compare the benefits of some of these new crops with existing crops? You know, farmers are in it to make money, and whatever program we lay out there has to have an economic incentive. Farmers have to be able to kind of earn a living off this as well. So we need a comparison to current crops that they're familiar with. We also did a survey of landowners in six major watersheds, just again to get an idea of what's their familiarity, what's their interest, what's their potential, what do they need to see in such a pilot program as well. Very useful information. Those are the people we need to convince to change their farming practices, and knowing where they're coming from is a critical piece. The water quality piece, you know, that's obviously our very direct interest. We work with the Pollution Control Agency on doing water quality monitoring, just to gauge how much change would have to happen on the landscape to generate a water quality benefit. And again, bear in mind the work that we did for the project last year was principally focused on surface water. What's important to keep in mind is that surface and groundwater really are the same water system on a statewide basis as well too. But again, the focus work was more on a surface water basis. And then we looked at what kind of subsidy would in fact be required based upon, you know, current crop prices at the time. The data models that were developed by the University of Minnesota can be modified to account for prices today or at any time to evaluate kind of what that break-even point would in fact be. So that's kind of very broad-based work we looked at to evaluate the interests, the motivation, the knowledge of producers, to look at the potential water quality benefits, and to look at the economic side. What kind of subsidies would be required to make a difference in this? So in terms of the elements of a working lands program that we feel we need to be built into a future program, you know, there are things that we think are important to look at that include flexibility. You know, give landowners some choices on the kind of crops they want to grow in terms of what their knowledge base is, what they're comfortable in growing, and where the markets may in fact exist so they can earn an economic return on their work. We think we need to take a look at the concept of risk management. When a producer makes change, they're accepting a degree of risk, and the payments that we'd be talking about would be intended to address some of that particular risk factor as well. While the same token, one of the cons we talked about is the funds the state would provide would cover that risk. If they're able to sell their commodity, that return would be theirs. We would not take account for that in the contract terms we'd enter into with with a producer. We also felt that a critical piece to move forward is on a source water protection. To move on a drinking water would be the should be the focus of any future implementation that we talked about. A very key thing, and other speakers will get this as well, is you need to develop really the entire supply chain to support producers in the growing of the plants, as well as on the market side as well. And we also think something we do with Rich Oliver programs is how do you get multiple benefits. We are going to be protecting groundwater as a folks we recommended, but there are other benefits as well that need to be incorporated into this kind of a program as well. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what I'd say is that I think the way the study left off is making some recommendations to move forward, and the legislation in front of you is intended to take those next steps. I'm with that happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Wyron. So is there any questions for this testifier? Hearing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the list, I have Mr. Meyer from the Minnesota Rural Water Association. If you'd like to come down, introduce yourself, and start your testimony, I would appreciate it.
Good afternoon. Aaron Meyer, Source Water Protection Specialist for Minnesota Rural Water Association. First of all, I want to thank the chairman and the committee for allowing me the opportunity to testify, and I'll try to get to some of the questions that were answered earlier. Let me start off. I'm going to focus a little bit more on the drinking water side of things. Minnesota Rural Water Association is a nonprofit group. We provide information, education, and technical assistance to municipalities, farmers, businesses, in an effort to protect basically public water supplies. So we're kind of one of the entities that focus on wastewater, water, and well protection in the state. So we have 1,000 members. We're a lion's share of that as municipalities, and we are covered throughout the state. So with that being said, I guess I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Rural Water and our representatives asking for your guys' support on this bill, because we feel this is a gap that's missing in some of those tools that we needed to better protect our drinking water supplies. I think there's a map in your guys' folder that shows kind of a statewide perspective. It's a map that was created by Minnesota Department of Health, and it shows some of the nitrate hotspots. And I was told it's black and white, so you might not be able to see it very good. But I just wanted to give you, the members of the committee, an idea of where we're seeing our elevated nitrates across the state. And you can largely see it's in the central sands, which runs pretty much northwest of the metro here, the southwest and the southeast. So, and the reason why I bring that up is that is the area where myself and other colleagues of Minnesota Rural Water Association focus our efforts. We work directly with the farmers and ranchers and municipalities in this area. And the reason why I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Rural Water asking for your support is we feel that one of the missing gaps we have is a program or a resource we can reach out to farmers where we can fit into their business models. They're running businesses just like a lot of the other gentlemen have already mentioned here. And we need something there that's not necessarily an easement, but it's a program that is there for a long-term sustainable program. What we're looking for here is something that we can go out, work with farmers and ranchers, where we can fit into their current management, and we can have something to offer to them besides the typical rotation that's in the corn and bean row crop. Some of the best managers in the world are here in Minnesota, but even the best managers in these sandy, coarse-textured soils are going to have nitrates that leach below the roots of their crops, which is causing the elevated nitrates. So we feel that having some kind of perennial living cover type of a program would allow a tool or resource for farmers to implement on the landscape and also help diversify the business model that they have on their end. With that, I think I'll keep it short and sweet.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Is there any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Meyer, for your time.
Thank you.
Next on the list, I have a Mr. Jason Overby. If you'd like to come forward, please introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jason Overby. I'm the general manager of Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water System down in southwest Minnesota. And I've been asked to help support this. I strongly support this measure. Aaron took a lot of my thunder. But Mr. Clark had talked about the 60,000-foot level. I'll bring it down to a small 1,000-foot level. Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water, there is a map included in your packet of our system. We are the largest rural water system in the state of Minnesota. We cover parts or all of 10 counties. We provide water to 36 and soon to be 37 communities, rural businesses, farms, and residents. We have, just to put things into perspective, we have 3,400 miles of pipeline. We don't have very many customers, but if you were to put that pipeline end to end, it would go from Cottage Grove to Seattle and back along I-90. So we have four DWISMAs, well fields, three of which are shallow in nature, 0 to 60 feet in depth from the glacial ridge, and are considered highly vulnerable by the Department of Health. So we have a lot of nitrate problems in those areas. And in fact, we are currently treating for nitrates through a reverse osmosis treatment plant, of which will be going away here and within the next 1 or 2 months. With that, our system is very aggressive on wellhead protection measures. We work closely with the landowners and constituents in the area. These well fields are strictly rural in nature, and they're fairly large. One of our DWISMAs is 36 square miles. Due to the discharge issue, we'll be losing the ability to treat, so therefore we are going to be shutting down approximately four production wells and losing about 400 gallons a minute of water from that treatment plant. We are a proponent of this type of thing. We are actually involved with the U of M and the Land Institute. We have 54 acres of Kernza planted at our well field right now and has been there for 1 year, and so we're waiting the results to see if there's any impacts to nitrates in our aquifers. So with that being said, working with the farmers and keeping a marketable cropping system in our well fields is conducive for all of us to work and operate in our area and yet maintain good quality water for our constituents. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Overby. Are there any questions for Mr. Overby? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mr. Overby. I'm kind of a beginner here, so I hope I don't embarrass myself with my ignorance, but I was looking at your maps, and I'm familiar with the areas that are presented here. One of them is in southeastern Minnesota, down by Chatfield, which I think is kind of an unglaciated area. The rest seem to be out in western Minnesota, which are glaciated or plains. Very different topographies, I guess. And yet they both are suffering from this nitrate concentration. Is there reason that they are different but share the same vulnerable characteristic, or what effect might the topography have on nitrate vulnerability?
Mr. Overby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there are two different topographies, and I'm not quite as familiar with the southeast. I know there's karst formations, and it's a little bit different structured than what we have. Ours is glacial outflow or outwash, so lots of sands and gravels after the glaciers advanced and retreated. And that's where our water sources are. So in one particular aquifer, if we see water in the ditch, essentially that's the top of the aquifer. Sometimes we'll have an aquifer that's got a cap, a clay cap over it, has provided a little bit more protection. But with these that we operate, there is a lot more vulnerability. So hopefully I answered your question.
Mr. Sandell? Representative Sandell, any further questions?
Thank you. That's fine.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Overby, for being with us. Can you, it's... Lincoln Pipestone does great work, and I'm very happy you're out there. But why do you think you were established in the first place?
Mr. Overby.
Yes, very good question. So back in the mid-70s, on a national level, the National Rural Water were forming and the state associations were forming. We also had a group of farmers and landowners that had poor quality water in that area, and they got together and created a steering committee to create a rural water system. We have very hard iron manganese water in that area. Sometimes it's it has arsenic and other constituents. The farmers and landowners there felt that if we can provide better quality water, life in general will be better, and for their livestock. We've seen an increase in livestock productivity since being on it.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Overby, for that answer. So did nitrate concentrations have anything to do with that original process of establishing the system?
Mr. Overby.
To my knowledge, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if nitrates were a concept when they were first creating the system. I think that all came about when we realized that this is an issue that we had to deal with and we had to treat for.
So, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Orby. Well, I'm certainly no expert in that part of the state. I live a little ways away from there, but you mentioned the problem of accessing quality water and how hard it is to drill an adequate well in that part of the state. I remember when we drilled the well for my hog barn about 15 years ago now, and the well driller said this is one of the highest producing wells he's ever drilled. And then he went on to talk about another hog producer who was trying to find water in that part of the state where Lincoln Pipestone is, and he had drilled five different wells and couldn't find enough water in any of those wells to supply his needs. And I think we need to understand that the nature of groundwater across the state of Minnesota varies dramatically from area to area and place to place, and the issues in this part of the state are not by no means strictly nitrate issues. There's many other issues with the quality of the groundwater, and while I'm not opposed to Forever Green and studying this and doing what we can, I think we need to make sure that we understand the entire issue.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. I didn't hear a question in there for the testifier.
I guess I forgot to put a question.
Do you have a? Okay, that's all right. Any further questions for Mr. Overby? Thank you. I will next call down Dr. Gus Minnie from, if you could come forward, introduce yourself, who you're with, and welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Gabe Guzmini. I work at PepsiCo. I'm the director of the crop improvement organization in the company. As such, I lead a group of about 12 scientists located on the St. Paul campus as part of a collaboration with the university. A big part of the collaboration is about looking at new crops that could potentially provide new raw materials for our food manufacturing and entering our supply chain, and the Forever Green program is a prime example of where we can study those crops and potentially understand how they can be applied into producing new products with both health benefits for the consumer, but also that lead an overall reduction of the upstream environmental footprint of our supply chains. In this particular case, this initiative is quite exciting because finally some of these crops are coming to fruition. And these initiatives start answering some of the big questions on how we can potentially scale up supply in the future in order to reach the big impact that we can have on the consumer. As a matter of factoid, we always mention that PepsiCo products are consumed about 1.5 billion times a day around the world. So could you imagine if even just a small percentage of that impact could deliver some crops that also have an upstream impact on water, environment, and farm productivity. We are committed to many of the crops in Forever Green, and we're experimenting with many of them, and so are some of our competitors, and we definitely support these and other initiatives related to it as key elements of mobilizing the whole supply chain in that direction. With that, more than happy to answer any question you might have.
Okay. Do we have any questions for this testifier? Thank you, Dr. Gusmini. I appreciate you coming forward. You're welcome. Next on the list of testifiers, I have Mr. Don Weiss from the University of Minnesota. Would you like to come forward, introduce yourself, and start your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman. I'm Don Weiss. I'm a member of the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota. I've been in that department for about 47 years. And I lead what is called the Forever Green Initiative. And it's an initiative that's been in place in various forms for about 20 years. So you're hearing a lot about Forever Green today, but it was under development for a long period of time. And as a matter of fact, in June of 1973, I was tricked to come to Minnesota from Michigan. A group of farmers in Roseau and Lake of the Woods counties invited me to come to their communities, and they brought me to Roseau in July, and everything looked fine. They invited me to come to Minnesota as a weed scientist, plant physiologist, to figure out how to control quackgrass so they could expand their grass seed industry. And you all know that's based on a series of perennial crops. So the framework for what we're talking about here in terms of moving this general idea across the state really came from that group of farmers going back over 50 years ago. And we were successful. We introduced a series of perennial ryegrass lines into that area of the state and provided a cover for that landscape, but what else? A tremendous economic pull. Basically, those lines that were introduced built a very strong component of that grass seed industry in those two counties. And no one has to beg those farmers to grow perennials. The lines that we released to them from the University of Minnesota yield about 1,500 pounds to the acre, and the farmer gets about $1 a pound. You understand, the debate's over. Mm-hmm. So with that success, we started to think about, can we do similar things across the rest of the state and really across the rest of the region? And when you look at the crops that were available, basically with the crops that were currently available, the opportunity to do the same thing just wasn't there. So my department was very supportive of a group of us. Today is about 50 people that took on this grand challenge of developing the next generation of crops, winter annuals and perennials. The last crop that was introduced from my department was soy. And that's almost 70 years ago, right? And that was in a public-private endeavor, that you know now, with soybeans covering half of the agricultural land in the state of Minnesota. The positioning now in terms of what we're describing is, okay, obviously my department, my team can develop new crops. Can you develop a new set of crops, the winter annuals and the perennials, that provide the new economic opportunity and provide those conservation services at the same time? So within this network of conversation we're talking about here today, that is the grand challenge, and I would argue that's the grand challenge for agriculture, the University of Minnesota, and we as citizens. Can we invest in a way that does provide these new economic opportunities for rural Minnesota, as well as providing the protection of, everyone talks about water, yes, water, but that soil as well. The soil health, the conservation of that soil is the basis of our communities across the entire Midwest. So let me tie a couple things that we're maybe moving around a little bit here today in terms of the bill that's in front of you. The bill that's in front of you is a result of some success that has been made in the development of these new forever green crops. In other words, they are in the early stages of becoming commercial. With our partners in marketing, you just heard from PepsiCo, The General Mills folks, I would say similar things. They are working with us to move those new grains into commercial products, right? But it's early stage. And we're now moving to the point where we want the farmers to start moving the production of those grains out on the landscape, but it all has to move in unison, right? We just can't turn grains over to a farmer and having them to produce them without support and without a market that's developing at the same time. So that's the phase that we're in. So the bill that's in front of you, I call a shared risk. Right, we don't want PepsiCo, General Mills to take on the entire risk, and we certainly don't want our farmers to take the entire risk. So this is a shared risk step forward, right? And doing it in a way to demonstrate economic impact, and also then the questions that was asked earlier, what is the impact on the water supply? Well, that has to be part of the questions that are being asked as we move forward. So from my vantage point, I can look all of you in the eye and say the Forever Green program and the development of the new crops is going very well. It's a long-term investment for the state of Minnesota, but we are making great progress. Let me just give you one additional example. A lot of you know about Kernza, the first perennial grain in the world released by the Forever Green program. It'll be going out. It's in seed increase. The University of Minnesota will be releasing its first variety this fall. The idea then is to then move it out into those areas that are very vulnerable for the first seed increases and for the first commercial plantings. The yields are low. In each cycle of selection, we're increasing the yield per acre by 200 pounds. So in 10 to 15 years, we will not need that subsidy. That's the argument, right? But in this early phase, the yields are lower than what we would like. Who's going to share that risk and move it forward? But the idea is that we do, in fact, have a very substantial breeding program behind this grain in the same way we developed a very good breeding program behind soy. The first lines of soy produced by the University of Minnesota yield about 18 bushel per acre. Now it's 80, right? 70 to 80 bushel per acre in some cases. The same general idea, basically having a breeding program in place that over time will reduce the need for this type of input to position to reduce the risk to the farmer. I'm going to give you one more. This one we're talking about is the Kernza is a perennial. The others that are under development are winter annuals. And I know some of the folks will giggle a little bit when we talk about pennycress being domesticated as a new oilseed crop. For some of you know that it has been a winter annual wheat in the United States for 150 years. The only thing you should remember, though, is it has about 40% oil. We took on the same challenge that the Canadians took on when they took rapeseed and produced canola. It took them, the Canadians, over two decades. We did exactly the same thing with the current technology, genetics and genomics technology, in 6 years. So in 2 years to 3 years, we'll be rolling out our first Minola. You get it? Yeah. That will be equivalent to or better than in terms of protein quality and oil quality over the next couple of years. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone was in tune with how the Forever Green investment relates to this bill. So the investment that is going on in this bill is to roll out the first plantings of this grain tied to real markets to make it happen and reduce risk across the entire production and supply and induced system.
Very good. Do we have any questions for this testifier? Dr. Wise, thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you
very
much.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this portion of the bill? Are there further questions for the author on this portion of the bill? Hearing none, I do have an A2 amendment that I would like to move at this point in time. The A2 amendment is an amendment covering a variety of different articles. I have worked with Mr. Jim Stark from the director of the Legislative Water Commission. I had talked to him to ask him to pull this together for me. When we were going through and taking a look at the legislation, some of the legislation recommendations that the commission had was drafted up in a variety of the jackets, and it seems some of the green jackets did not quite make it through the process. Just with as many people as we were coordinating, we seem to have lost track of them. And so what I asked Mr. Stark to do is to pull together this A2 amendment to make sure that we didn't miss anything along the line from the original recommendations that the Legislative Water Commission had. So at this point in time, I'd like to call Mr. Stark up, and he can kind of walk through each section here. I do know that we have some blanks for appropriation amounts. I do have those dollar amounts. And as we get to those areas, I will then do amendments while we do an amendment to the amendment. While we have rules on the amendments, we don't have rules on the amendments to the amendments. And so then we can go through seeing where Finance Committee, as was referenced last time, we have blank appropriations. I do have recommendations for the blank appropriations that will handle after we've done the walkthrough of the amendment here. Mr. Stark, if you'd like to proceed, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jim Stark. I'm the director of the Legislative Water Commission. The amendments contained in this document today are 8 of the 13 bills and recommendations that have been put forward by the Legislative Water Commission. These bills are the result of the Commission's review of existing water quality reports and recommendations over many years. That process of review was followed up by a series of stakeholder meetings over the summer, which was followed up by a survey of over 500 water experts within the state. The result of that process were 13 recommendations. I'm going to talk very briefly today about 8 of them. The protection and preservation of waters of the state is one of our most critical responsibilities within government. This amendment addresses many aspects of ensuring sustainable water for drinking and for the environment, and I'll briefly step through each of the 8. The first one is about fee setting. It updates the Minnesota Department of Health's drinking water service connection fee. Legislation is needed to increase that fee by the Minnesota Department of Health. That fee is used to complete condition assessments and asset management plans to ensure the safety of drinking water from public supply systems. That's the first of the subdivisions. The second is about inflow and infiltration. Our leaky storm sewers affect the quality of our drinking water, our groundwater quality, and the cost of wastewater treatment. Broken sewer lines affect our ability to successfully treat wastewater, and the problem continues to grow over time. This legislation is needed to ensure that the Metropolitan Council can use existing streams of revenue for public and private property inflow and infiltration mitigation in the same way that our cities do. The third is involves appropriations to assess the effects of flooding, drought, land use, and population change. In short, we need to begin to plan for an uncertain future. Policy is needed to guide adaptation for changes that likely will occur in climate, landscapes, biota, hydrology, and to our infrastructure. This work provides a plan for agency and legislative action as a very first step in that process. The fourth is preserving and protecting our lakes. This effort begins a process to plan to protect our lakes. It increases data collection and analysis for our lakes. It establishes an interagency working group to coordinate data collection and analysis that includes continuous monitoring. It would prepare an interagency plan to integrate lake assessment results into regulatory programs to protect all of our lakes and to preserve and protect the most significant and valuable of our lakes. It provides assessments of lakes focused on the potential effects of climate change and management practices that can mitigate those impacts. The fifth involves drinking water and wastewater infrastructure. Our water infrastructure is aging and presents threats to our economy and to the public health. This subdivision would support and accelerate cost effectiveness reviews. It would support funding to increase the MPCA and Department of Health's efforts to encourage alternative best management practices, including asset management reviews and the implementation of efficient infrastructure alternatives for our cities and towns. It provides support for market-based water quality trading options among willing municipalities and accelerates programs that address the worst of our leaking septic systems. The sixth is to provide clean and sustainable groundwater for the future. This would expand information and management for clean and sustainable drinking water. It would improve our understanding of our water bank accounts as a pilot in One County Atlas and in One Watershed, One Plan initiative. It would make better use of the information we are collecting, would coordinate water planning, and increase public education about groundwater. The seventh is about water retention, or keeping water on the land. Keeping water on the land reduces erosion and improves soil health and water quality, increases groundwater recharge, and improves agricultural production. This initiative would provide support for return on investment analysis of conservation drainage. It would promote pilot watershed pollutant trading and banking programs, implement and fund an effective credit exchange mechanism, and would support programs to provide a better understanding of the extent of tile drains and ditches and their hydrologic consequences. And the final one involves water education. We know that water education in our K through 12 programs are not adequate. This would fund a pilot program to increase water education in our public schools, which would be a pilot for moving forward. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's a very brief summary of the eight subdivisions, and if I can stand for questions now, I would be happy to. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stark. Before I start doing any of the amendments, what I'd like to do is, first of all, find out, are there any particular questions for Mr. Stark? I don't see any. I do know that there is one testifier that we have. Ms. Gretel Lee, if you're here, if you'd like to come down and testify. Welcome to the table. Please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Gretel Lee. I'm an environmental attorney with the firm of Flaherty and Hood, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Greater Minnesota Cities today, commonly known as the CGMC. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1569 as amended. In particular, I am testifying in support of Section 7 that appropriates state funds for drinking and wastewater infrastructure and program funding. I want to note that currently CGMC is not taking a position on the other amendment provisions. CGMC has participated in the Legislative Water Commission's processes and has supported these ideas, as water quality protection is of the utmost importance to our members. Our members work daily in the areas of drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater in their respective cities, and they know firsthand the kinds of challenges that Minnesota cities face when it comes to addressing water quality and having enough money to pay for these improvements to aging infrastructure. Statewide, it's no secret that Minnesota is facing many water quality challenges and that there are limited resources to meet these challenges. And so CGMC wanted to make sure that a representative was here today to voice support for this amendment and that section in particular, as it appropriates additional state funding to address these issues and support these programs. We also would like to note that it encourages a collaborative approach between the impacted communities and the state of Minnesota, which is something that is very important to CGMC members. With that, CGMC urges the adoption of Section 7 as it appropriates those vital funds that are very important to greater Minnesota cities. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Are there any questions for Ms. Lee? Okay, hearing none, thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Next thing I'd like to do is I'd like to go through some of the different sections here and put in dollar amounts. These were things that, working with Mr. Stark, we were able to pull together over the last day or so. And the first amendment to the amendment I would like to do, and I'm trying to think of the easiest way to do that, so I may reference staff. I've got a number of dollar amounts to be placing in here. What I'd like to do is call out the line and the dollar amount. I'll call out the line and the dollar amount that I'm looking at doing as an amendment to the amendment as I go through here. And starting on page 3, where I've got the first set of blanks here, on line 3.12, right after the numeral 1, $50,000 being inserted there, and then in the second blank following that would be $50,000. Then on line 3.16, and as I'm going through here, I'm just going to reference first, making sure I'm going slow enough for staff, so if staff has any questions, please slow me down as we go through here. Then on line 3.16, right after the numeral 2, there's a blank there. That should be $25,000. The second blank on that same line would also be $25,000. Next, I'll move down to line 3.22. After the numeral 3, there is a blank for a dollar amount there. That should be $25,000. The second blank for a dollar amount on that line should also be $25,000. Then, going down to line 3.27, right after the numeral 4, there is a blank for a dollar amount. That should be replaced with the number 50,000. And then later on that same line, there's a second blank dollar amount. That should also be 50,000. Then, flipping over to page 4. Page 4, after the numeral 5, I have a blank dollar amount. That should be changed to 25,000. On that same line, 4.1, there is another dollar blank. That should also be 25,000. Then on line 4.4, after the numeral 6, that should be 25,000. And then later on in that same line of 4.4, there's another dollar blank. That should also be 25,000. Then moving on to line 4.7, after the numeral 7, there's a dollar blank. That should be $50,000. Later on that same line of 4.7, there's a second dollar blank. That should be changed to read $50,000. Then on page 5, line 5.4, after the numeral 1, the dollar blank should be changed to $200,000. Later on that same line of 5.4, there is another dollar blank. That should also be changed to $200,000. Then as we go down to line 5.22, the dollar blank on line 5.22, the first one after the numeral 2, should be $100,000. The second dollar blank on that same line of 5.22 should be $100,000. On line 5.26, after the numeral 3, the dollar blank should be changed to $200,000. Later on that same line of 5.26, the number is the blank should be 200,000. Moving on down to line 5.29, right after the numeral 4, there's a dollar blank. That should be changed to 100,000. And then later on in that same line, there's a second dollar blank. That should be changed to 100,000. And that is it for my amendment to the amendment with the dollar amounts. questions? Do we need staff to review it all? Questions? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things.
Sure.
How did we come to those numbers? I mean, where are those coming from?
Okay. I will refer. Thank you for the question, Representative Heintzman. Mr. Stark, if you could please let us know how you came up with the dollar amounts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, thanks for the question. The numbers, first of all, the numbers for the totals for each of the subdivisions really arrived at through discussions with the agencies. So, and quite a lot of discussion back and forth among the agencies arriving at those numbers. The subdivisions within each one of the subdivisions themselves were allocated based on what information I had from the agencies and based on my understanding of the priorities within each of those subdivisions.
Representative Heintzman.
Then what are the funds that those numbers, those dollars are being drawn upon?
My recommendation is would be the general fund. These would all be appropriations from the general fund. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's been a reoccurring theme, but you know, once again, we're wondering, we've created so many opportunities for these things to be funded, whether it be at LCCMR, Clean Water Fund, and other places, and we're calling on the general fund for millions and millions of dollars, even after the creation of these opportunities. It's a little bit tiring. And I appreciate, you know, that we had an opportunity to visit a little bit about the difficulty with these bills being lost, and then trying to put something together here just a few days before deadline. It would have been really nice to be able to hear each of these bills and find out exactly what their impacts might be and how the dollars were going to be spent. I understand the agencies are developing some kind of numbers, but I mean, $50,000, $25,000, $25,000, $50,000, it sounds a little arbitrary. And I have to speak up for the public in this case is, we don't know a lot about what's going to be done here, and I appreciate Jim coming and sharing a little bit about the folks that were called on. I think he said there were 500 surveys that were distributed, but you know, the public doesn't have an opportunity to weigh in on this necessarily. We have a very small amount of time here as we're coming up, like I said, the deadline. So I'm not sure how to feel about just moving forward and plowing ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Heintzman, for your concerns. I appreciate you letting me know about them. In terms of the overall dollar amounts, first of all, the amendment was posted in advance, and we did have the general dollar amounts on the very top that were originally requested. And what I had asked for is to do some better breakdown of where the dollars needed to go. So in terms of the total dollar amounts, we had originally had those figured out earlier on. It was just figuring out how do they go into the section afterwards. So in terms of the total dollar amounts that were being requested for each subsection were notified out to the public. We did have them out in the amendment beforehand that was posted in time. We're just trying to make sure that we're identifying a source of revenue that we can make sure we'll address these issues that are going forward. It's also something that we're not necessarily committed that will eventually be this one funding source, but it's something that we're looking for at as we're going to continue down the road. And based on inputs that we have, this is just the first stop for this. This will be also vetted at some of the others, and I will keep your consideration in mind as we're going forward with this amendment here that goes on. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to just quickly ask. You mentioned that there may be another fund that's considered other than the general fund. I would make a very strong argument that Clean Water Fund or even some other funds be considered as opposed to the general fund. We're talking about a significant amount of money, and we have heard a number of bills that are reaching into the general fund, and with a changing forecast, I think everybody's really questioning what should and shouldn't be coming out of general fund. We have a lot of needs around the state, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your concern, Representative Heintzman. I appreciate it. Representative Torkelson, you have some questions, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Starr, for bringing these forward. You know, frankly, I'm not sure that, well, I've been very involved with this process up to this point. I'm not sure that every one of these is exactly ready for prime time, so to speak. I'm happy that we are going to continue the conversation on these variety of issues. Some of them may need more time to bake, so to speak, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that you brought them forward and that we will continue the discussion and that we may hopefully pick out the nuggets that are the most appropriate to move forward at this time, or at this year, I should say. But it might not be all of them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Torkelson. I look forward to your continued input. What we're trying to do is make sure that we're not losing any of the recommendations now, and continue looking forward to the input. At some point, we're probably not going to be able to do everything that we've got outlined here, but we don't know until we start asking, and then be able to continue the discussions of what is worth keeping forward when we start having to make those choices. So thank you so much. I look for your continued input. Other questions? Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Lippert for bringing this bill forward. What could be more important than protecting the drinking water for the people of the state of Minnesota? And I think the creative ideas that you brought forward are important. Thank you.
One of the questions before we get too much further on is I have made a recommendation for amendment to the amendment. We have not voted on that. Right, so I have to first make incorporate the changes of the amendment to the amendment in. So at this point in time, I would like to move, I would like to take the vote on the okay. I would like to incorporate the changes that I have made into the A2 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion approves. Now we have the amended A2. The amendment is adopted. Now we are on to the main bill that we have before us. Are there any final comments or questions for Representative Lippert? Hearing none, Representative Lippert, is there any final comments you'd like to make at this point in time?
I think this is meeting a clear need. There's a strong group of broad support. Supporters behind the bill, so I would urge support of the bill.
Okay. Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1569, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment Finance Division. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. That is our only bill for today. I appreciate the committee's involvement at this point. Is there anything else? Does anyone have anything else? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.